Members and public, we're going to get started. I'm calling the House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform to order. We do have a quorum. Today, we're going to have a good conversation with a number of public safety divisions that do some critically important work that often doesn't get seen by the public, but it's absolutely critical to our public safety and our sense of well-being in our state. So I'm looking forward to a real rich sharing from them. I would encourage members as they present that we ask questions as we go along, as opposed to past hearings where I've had you hold your questions to the end. We do have to take care of a little bit of business, and so I'm wondering if Representative Mulder, if you can make a motion.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes from the January 22nd meeting.
Very well. All members, the motion is approved minutes of January 22nd. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. We will have the minutes from the 23rd, but that's a little bit complicated because we were meeting with our subcommittee as well. So we're needing to coordinate it with them on that. So with that, I'm just wondering, is there anything anyone needs to share before I invite folks up? I don't know. I thought maybe I'd try that as a kind of an icebreaker here. Any ideas or thoughts or information? All right, everyone's playing their cards close to the chest. I love it. All right, with that.
Yes,
very good.
And I would like to agree with you and just say that I have toured the two prisons out in my district in Stillwater and Oak Park Heights. And so if you didn't sign up, I don't know if it's too late, but it's an amazing experience, and it's something, it's not what you expect, and it's all those things. It's a little bit of movies, and so it's a great thing, and especially people on this corrections committee, I think. So I highly suggest attending.
Thank you, Representative Christensen, for that encouragement. It's actually been many, many years since I've been out to any of our institutions. I think Stillwater might have been the last one, and that's well over a decade ago. So I'm really looking forward to doing that tour. Representative Johnson.
Chair Marianne, I see in our packets we don't have the overviews of these PowerPoints. I'm just wondering if we could, after today, if our staff and members could get copies of them.
Representative Johnson, you have my commitment. We'll do that. And I think the department folks probably heard that, and they've been very good about being very transparent with us. I have no doubt that'll be coming soon. So we'll take note of that. Absolutely. Anything else? Very well. Yeah. Oh, okay. We'll find out. So with that, we'll have the department representatives come forward. Welcome to the committee. We're looking forward to this presentation and the conversation as well. If you could state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Cassandra O'Hearn, and I currently serve as the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. And I'm excited to share this overview with you. The Department of Public Safety provides a core governmental function. The department is committed to making Minnesota safer in a variety of different ways. Of course, to protect the citizens and communities. And how do we do that? It's through prevention, preparation, response, recovery, education, and enforcement. The focus always on saving lives, providing efficient, effective services, and at all times maintaining the public trust and developing strong partnerships. Commissioner Harrington has already provided, I believe, the committee structure and all the various divisions within the Department of Public Safety. But today, you're going to hear from the directors of the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, the Fire Marshals Division, Emergency Communication Networks, and Homeland Security and Emergency Management.
Please proceed, Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. As we go through, I'm not going to talk about the history, and I understand that you may not have a copy of the PowerPoint. We'll make sure that we get that to you. Not going to go through the history here, but we'll note that the position of the state fire marshal, one of the divisions you're going to hear from today, was the first in 1905, and the Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management was one of the latter ones with 2004. The Department of Public Safety coming into creation in 1969, just to put into historical context, that's what the troopers were driving at that time. So with that, I will call up the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division Director, Carlos Encada, and she will provide an overview of what we affectionately call AGED.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner, and welcome, Director Sincada.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carla Sincada, and I am the Director of the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. Our mission is to protect and serve the public through the uniform interpretation, regulation, and enforcement of the state's liquor laws and gambling laws and rules. We provide stability and integrity throughout the gaming and liquor industries. We do this through the management of licensing, education, regulation, and enforcement. On the alcohol side of our division, we provide, as mentioned, the education, regulation, and enforcement. We issue and approve approximately 36,000 liquor licenses and over 52,000 brand labels. We conduct pre-license and compliance inspections and investigate complaints related to trade practice or industry concerns. Our staff includes 5 licensing staff, 5 non-sworn investigators, and 2 administrators. On the gambling side of the house, again, the focus on education and regulation, enforcement of the gambling laws, we investigate and enforce crimes related to gambling fraud and illegal gambling. We provide information and assistance to the gaming industry, the public, and other law enforcement agencies. We conduct background investigations and provide licensing throughout the gaming industry. And we also verify compliance with the tribal state compacts for the 11 tribes at 20 casinos. Our staff includes 5 special agents, 2 supervisory special agents, and 1 project consultant. Our division receives an annual appropriation of $2.74 million. We collect $1.24 million per year in special revenue, $500,000 of which each year is transferred to the general fund. The Gambling Control Board also transfers $70,000 to our division each year. Our special revenue monies are derived from the tribal state compacts, fingerprint submission fees, 2 AM license fees, micro distillery license, and electronic pull tabs. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, do you have any questions?
Thank you, Director Sincada. I'm wondering if you can quickly tell us the difference between your division and the Minnesota Gambling Division.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Minnesota Gambling Control Board is the regulatory authority which oversees the charitable organizations, and they are responsible for licensing and issuing permits for all lawful forms of gambling within the state of Minnesota.
Very well. And Director Sincada, I'm just curious, there are 11 tribal nations, legal entities and sovereign legal entities in our state. Tell us a little bit about what the nature of that relationship is. Are there things that get in the way of the division being able to be effective in communicating with, to the contrary? Just paint us a little picture about how that relationship is at this point.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our division is responsible for monitoring compliance with the tribal state compacts. The tribal state compacts govern the play of blackjack and video games of slots, or slot machines. What we do is guided by the compacts, and our division goes out on a quarterly basis to complete physical inspections of the slot machines and the play of blackjack to ensure that the games are being played in compliance with the compact. Fortunately, we enjoy very good relationships with our tribal communities. There are no barriers, and we have good cooperative working relationships with them.
Terrific. Members, are there any questions? Yeah, Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Chair. Just curious what 2 a.m. licenses are.
Director Sincana.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the 2 a.m. license fee is a permit that is issued by the state for any retail establishment that wishes to have to sell alcohol beyond 1 a.m. And then, just a liquor license.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions? And Deputy Commissioner, my understanding is that there are proposals that will be coming forward from all these divisions, but we're not ready for those yet because the governor is still to, constructing that. So I do look forward to hearing about those at a future date.
You are correct, Mr. Chair, and we look forward to working with you and the committee members and to present proposals as we're able to do so.
Super. Thank you. Well, Director Sincana, thank you for your testimony. Is this your first time testifying at a legislative hearing?
Mr. Chair, this is my second.
Your second? Okay. All right. Right. We're angling for the donuts. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us here today, Director.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
Very well. Deputy Commissioner.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would like to introduce the State Fire Marshal and the Director of the State Fire Marshal's Division, as well as the Office of Pipeline Safety, although we're talking about the State Fire Marshal's Office today. Bruce West.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I am Bruce West. I'm the State Fire Marshal, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today. And you'll see the mission of the State Fire Marshal Division is to protect lives and property by fostering a fire-safe environment. I'm going to cover a few little just history tips here, or little statistics about the fire service of Minnesota. Excuse me. We have 775 fire departments across the state. And some of you may know that. Some of you may be a little surprised about that. But there's only 19 fully career departments across the state. Of those 775, only 19 are fully career. Now we have 80 what we call combination departments. They may have some full-time staff, but the firefighting, let's say, is done by paid-on-call firefighters. And that means they get a small stipend. They may get paid per call. They may get paid per hour. But those paid-on-call firefighters could be plumbers, electricians, teachers, homemakers, whatever in a community. And then we have 676 volunteer or paid-on-call departments. We have many volunteer departments, true volunteer departments, yet in the state of Minnesota. And what I mean by that is they don't get paid any stipend for either fire calls, drills that they have in their local agency, their local department. So it's quite a mixture throughout the state. And of those 775 fire departments, we have 20,800 firefighters across the state. That's just a round ballpark number, but 20,800 departments. In our division, and I just give you an idea of how many firefighters and, the fire chiefs, 775 fire departments, you're going to have a fire chief that leads each one of those agencies. And in our world, we call them the HJ, the Authority Having Jurisdiction. But most of those departments are, the first bullet that you see up on the screen, investigation is probably the one area that they're going to see our department. We're going to reach out and work with them as on fire investigations. Cause and determination. All fires start local, and the local AHJ, the local fire chief, needs to determine the cause and determination of that fire. If they need assistance, they call our office. In 2018, we did over 700 calls. We had 700 calls for service, and some of those may have simply been a consultation over the phone, but most of them were on scene, where our 12 investigators, we have 12 fire investigators throughout the state of Minnesota, and they went to the scene to assist that local fire chief or maybe one of the firefighters that was the incident commander on that incident. So that's where we're really visible within the fire service. But there's many other areas. But this is really our number one area that we have the visibility with those 775 departments across the state.
Director, I'm going to interrupt quickly here. Representative Nash has a question.
Afterwards.
Oh, okay, you're good?
Yep.
All right, very good.
After they're done.
All right, super. I apologize.
Director, no problem, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Next, you'll see enforcement of the state fire code. We are in many different facilities across the state. We go to nursing homes. We'll go to schools, both the public and charter schools, to do code enforcement, and there's other areas. We go into hotel, motel also. But if a local fire chief calls with an issue within their community, we will send one of our inspectors out to work with that local fire chief on the issue they may have in their community, whether it's a church or whatever the facility is that they have a question or they have an issue that they want to discuss. So we'll reach out and we'll work with that local. Next, emergency response. Just yesterday we had a fairly large incident up in Glenwood. Some of you may have seen it, where numerous fire departments were on the scene. One of our fire service specialists went to the scene to assist that local fire chief, that local incident commander. We never go there to take over the scene. We're simply there to assist, to be a liaison for potential state resources that may need to assist that locality with that incident. We do that quite often throughout the year, where some of our staff will be on the incident of a larger type fire. Data collection, for us, it's all about data. We study that data. We get about 300,000 fire incidents per year reported to our office. And we have 775 fire departments, as I stated earlier. And we have, last year we had all but five reported their fire incidents to our division. That's a phenomenal number. It's a record number. And we're continuing to work to strive to get every one of those to submit their fire incidents during the year. So we do a lot of data collection. Last one you'll see is public education. It's all about public education for our division and working with the localities, with the local fire departments, providing them. We have fire and life safety educators that work with the fire chiefs across the state on getting the messages out so we can reduce our fire fatalities across the state. So that's some key areas that we have within our division. And lastly, you'll see the State Fire Marshal Division receives an annual appropriation of $6.42 million in special reserve funds. Mr. Chair and committee members, I'll stand for any questions.
Super. Thank you, Director. We do have a couple of questions. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. West, you know, in my previous elected life, I was a mayor in Waconia, and one of the things that we struggled with, and I know probably many of the people around this table do as well, are the all-volunteer fire departments. Not having daytime coverage, and you collect a lot of data, and I'd like to pick your brain on that. But then secondly, regarding that, what's the trend across the state for daytime coverage? Because in the city of Waconia and many other cities in my district, folks work, so they're not able to provide consistent daytime coverage, so there's a lot of mutual aid calls that go out. So wondering trends on that, but then also wondering trends on that movement between all volunteer to beginning with paid full-time chief and then paid full-time firefighters. Have you looked at that trend? Have you begun offering assistance to the fire departments around the state Just kind of curious as to where that's going from your perspective and what data you've got on it you can share with us.
Director Wells.
Mr. Chair and committee members, great questions. And I'll take the first one in reference to the daytime coverage. You're seeing a lot of departments across the state that are doing automatic aid, especially during the day. What I mean by automatic aid is if there's a structure fire, residential fire, it could be any fire in that community. So that community is requesting automatic aid through dispatch, through the local public safety answering point, through the county, is that the next nearest department would automatically be paged at literally the same time. So now instead of just that community, you may have two or three localities close by that are responding all at the same time. And you may get four departments there, and you may end up with 12 people because that's just the way it is during the day. Is there are some departments that are, they can muster three or four firefighters during the day, but at night, because you're right, they're working 8 to 4, 8 to 5, 7 to 6, whatever, and they are not able to leave their place of employment. So, but at night, they'll muster 25 or 30 firefighters. So that's, recruitment retention is the number one issue in the state of Minnesota for firefighters and across the nation when it comes to, volunteer fire departments. And then the other piece was the movement from going to volunteer paid on call to career. You're seeing that, one quick example of that is in Eagan, and you probably have read some information on that, where Chief Mike Scott is moving away from a paid-on-call environment, hiring some career staff and moving, and you're seeing Roseville just lately, moving that way also. So we're following that, and we're getting phone calls from all across the state from mayors, council persons about that type of scenario where about the first thing they're going to say is we can't afford that. What can we do here in this community?
Representative Nash.
And thank you again, Mr. Chair. And that's the crux of the issue is having managed that budget and set that levy every year, the financials that go behind one automatic mutual aid calls, well, that gets expensive really fast. But then you look at the role of the volunteer fire department in the community. And I don't ever want to lose the volunteer fire departments because they are literally sometimes the lifeblood of the community with charitable gambling and just hours of service that they put in. And I would hope that we're involving as many folks as we possibly can to address this issue because I think it's going to be, I don't want to use the word crisis because that's overused, but it's going to be something that's going to be very impactful for small cities around the state. And it's something I think that we here at the legislature should be a part of that solution. Again, having sat in the mayor and council members chair myself, you talk about it a lot. And I want to make sure that we're addressing those issues so that we can help those fire departments, but that we're working with you to pick your brain. Because if you're collecting data from everybody, it would be beneficial to put reports out as to trends, and the different things that you're analyzing that can be useful to council members, mayors, and legislators as well.
Mr. Chair and committee members, we'll be happy to provide that information. Through our data collection, we know when the department A that had the fire and if they have automatic aid or their mutual aid, that's all reported in our what we call our Minnesota Fire Incident Reporting System. So all of that comes to us. And so John Nishi, who's our supervisor of our data team, they are constantly looking at that type of data. So we'd be happy to work on that.
Fire Marshal, this raises just a quick thought on my part. If you mentioned this earlier, I apologize. I've been juggling a couple of things here. But state retirement, access to state retirement, what is the retirement scenario for these volunteer firefighters? Do they participate in a state system? Is it not addressed? Is it a mixed bag? What can you quickly tell us about that?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I did not mention that earlier, but that's no problem. Most fire departments across the state have what they call relief associations.
Okay,
so they receive some funding that goes into their relief that is for the firefighters, and some of them are either defined benefit or defined contribution. So depending on which system they have, many of you know defined contribution is let's just make it easy, this piece of the pie scenario, where a defined benefit, they might be getting $1,000 or $1,500 or $4,000 per year of service. It all depends on their assets. They do actuarial studies on their assets, so they know what they can pay for their firefighters. They have a vesting system, so it's either 5 years, 10 years, 15, or 20. 20 would be the normal, would be your maximum, or your 100% vested, and so they would start at 60 and then move up, and 60%, I'm sorry. And so that, yes, and the fire departments across the state have that that type of a pension system. It's called the Relief Association.
Very well. Thank you, Director West. We have questions from Representative Johnson and then Representative Long. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members, most of you who don't know, we have a lot of volunteer fire departments and volunteer firemen in the state. The actual percentage is close to 90% of our firefighters are all volunteer. They do a fabulous job. But unlike Representative Nash, I will call it crisis mode. We have a lot of departments that do not have the men and women on their departments to do the job anymore. You go through any town anywhere in the state of Minnesota, especially in greater Minnesota, and the billboard at the park is firefighters wanted. Everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I was at my former fire department I was a member of at their Christmas party. When I was on, we had 25 members. And that gave us, we were still shorthanded a little bit in the daytime, but right now they're down to 14 members. And to get a new member on, because of all the rules and regulations, not just that the state has put on and at the federal level, especially OSHA, you're looking at 2 years of training from the time you get hired as a volunteer to the time you go into a fire. We got to figure out a way to get these people willing to volunteer, and it's a huge time and commitment that these people do to go on a department. It's a huge expense to the city and the department to train these individuals. And by the time they get to 2 years, they are burned out because of all the training, and they leave. We need to find a way to get those people active and actually helping out with the fires, because it's that important. It's getting to the point now we're in crisis mode, because these fire departments are continually being required to do more and more things. They're in rural, in greater Minnesota, they're the first responders to any medical. They're the first responders to car accidents. They might be on scene at a medical doing CPR for 20 minutes before an ambulance gets there. Our volunteer fire departments are the lifeblood of our communities, and we need to do what we can to get them going again. I also want to thank the fire marshal's office for the great training they do. As a firefighter, I went to numerous training courses across the state. The fire and arson investigation training, I was lucky. I had probably one of the best fire marshals in the state ever doing my training. Unfortunately, he passed away with Jamie Novak. He was fabulous on the scene at fires. He was fabulous at training. But again, I want to thank you for the work the fire marshal does. But I also would like to know, some of these members don't know where the funds from the special revenue come from, if you could explain that.
Very good question. Director West, please.
Okay. Mr. Chair and committee members, I'll be happy to discuss. It comes from the fire safety account. And the fire safety account is an assessment that goes on insurance policies. If I like round numbers, so I'll use on a $1,000 homeowner's insurance policy, it's $5. It's 0.05%. So on that $1,000, that $5 would go into the fire safety account, and it collects approximately $13 million. And that goes to the, support the State Fire Marshal Division, the Minnesota Board of Firefighter Training and Education, which provides, training dollars to the fire departments across the state, all 775 of them. And then also some funding for the state response teams that you hear later from Director Kelly from Homeland Security Emergency Management. That's where the funding from the fire safety councils.
Very well. And members, I will, the chair will in the near future ask our staff, particularly our fiscal staff, to walk through the various accounts that we're charged with making decisions about. In retrospect, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. You know, it might have been a good thing to do, as we heard from each one of these divisions. But we certainly will walk through those together at a future date. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director West, I'm curious if you track some of the occupational hazards that firefighters are exposed to, and in particular if you are tracking or have any data on exposure to toxic flame retardant chemicals.
Director West.
Yep, Mr. Chair and committee members, we're very aware of the exposures that the firefighters have, and there's also a state registry when it comes to cancer and things. And on the reports that we receive, you know, we'll get that information through the report that would come from that individual department to our office. So that's part of our data collection.
Representative Long.
Mr. Chair, Director West, is that data publicly available or something you could make accessible?
Director West.
Mr. Chair, committee members, absolutely. That is published data. We have a report every year that we call Fire in Minnesota, and we've been doing that for many years, and that's a compilation of those 300,000 fire incidents. So if you're looking for some specific data, we'd be happy to assist you. We could provide that to the committee.
Super. Appreciate it. I see no further questions, and so Fire Marshal West, thank you for being with us today and for our time
yesterday
going over these issues as well. Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'd like to call the Emergency Communication Networks Division, introduce you to Dana Wahlberg.
Good afternoon, Director. If you can give us your name and maybe spell it out, because I keep checking to make sure I got Sincada because my last name is Mariani, you know, so that, you know, like that rolls for me, but some other names just don't quite do it for me. Not do it for me, but they don't fit my cultural lens, if you will, of immediate recognition. So welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dana Wahlberg. Spelling D-A-N-A, last name W-A-H-L-B-E-R-G, no relation to Mark.
I was going to ask you for an autograph. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I am representing the Division of the Emergency Communication Networks of the Department of Public Safety, and our mission is to really provide enhancement for the emergency communication networks in the state and to provide solid and strong partnerships professionally with all of the responders for law, fire, and EMS that respond to emergency incidents. And in order to do that, we have kind of an overarching set of goals, and that is to enhance the ability for citizens and visitors to the state of Minnesota to be able to call for help using the digits 911, to provide confidence that responders in every corner of the state have the ability to communicate with one another, and to enhance the capability to ensure that every county in the state of Minnesota has an ability to warn and alert their citizens in a situation of impending danger. So we have four specific emergency communication networks within our division. They are 911, land mobile radio, wireless broadband, and integrated public alert and warning. And to give you a little bit of a perspective of those, when we look at the continuum, it starts with the 911 call. That's the public reaching out, dialing 911 to solicit help. The call is answered in a 911 call center, and from there, the staff within the 911 call center alerts the public safety responders by way of land mobile radio to respond to the incident. Once their response has been initiated, the responders communicate back and forth with one another using wireless broadband. It may be voice, it may be data, Most likely it's a combination of both of those. And then finally, in situations when they're on the scene and maybe they realize that the incident has reached such a scale that it poses an immediate threat to the public that are within that vicinity, they would then have the ability to reach back to the 911 call center and have them provide an alert and warning message to the public within a given geographic or geofenced area to either shelter in place or to evacuate or provide them with some type of information on what to do to remain safe. So in looking at our 911 program first, the 911 network was originally built to support wireline calls. And now, as technology has continued to develop, we have, for example, last year we answered just shy of 3 million 911 calls in the state of Minnesota, and 81% of those calls came from wireless devices, not from your typical landline wireline phone. So given the change in technology and the expectation that people have to be able to communicate with 911 using the same technology that they use to communicate with their smartphones, with their family and friends, there's been a national trend to completely revamp the 911 network. And we're proud to say that Minnesota is a leader in that venue. We are probably within one of the top four states in that deployment from the legacy or the old 911 system to the next generation or new 911 system.
Director Wahlberg, I'm going to interrupt. We have a question from Representative Johnson, but I do want to make a quick comment that my grandkids couldn't point out what a landline phone is, and I put it in front of them. You know, just kind of an interesting object. They have no idea what it is. And forget about it if it's a rotary system. They wouldn't even know how to operate that. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, the testifier. As you're changing to a wireless broadband system and wireless communication, we have areas in greater Minnesota where we're in trouble. I have places in my district 50 miles north of here. In fact, there's areas in Anoka County where there is no cell phone coverage, let alone broadband coverage. The people that live in those areas know what a landline is because that's the only communication they have. And that's inside the 7-county metro area. So we got to be careful how we do this move forward, because if you go too fast, you're going to leave people with no communication.
And Director Wahlberg, that'll also touch on when you'll talk about the wireless broadband system as well. But please feel free to issue some thoughts on.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the wireline infrastructure will continue to be able to support 911 calls for those that are not living in a wireless world. And as I get into the presentation a little bit further and talk about wireless broadband, there is an initiative there where we are working very closely within every county of the state to examine coverage needs and to work with the carriers to improve those and enhance those.
Terrific.
Representative Jones. Yeah, just a little bit of follow-up on that. I know they're doing that. Unfortunately, what I'm hearing from some of the companies that are installing this stuff, they're forcing the counties and the local jurisdictions to pay for infrastructure because it's not fiscally feasible to put the stuff in. In my home county, they just got the estimate of the bill to put the infrastructure in for Isani County, over $70 million. That's almost more than our county budget now. It's very expensive. These companies got the CAF II funding, but they only put it in areas where it was areas that the population was big enough to support the stuff. Now, if the counties put the infrastructure in, who's going to be responsible for those lines when they break? The county. And you're looking at $10,000 just to repair one line. one break in the line. So we got the wireless might work, the wired might go, but the broadband issue is a very difficult issue to deal with, and the cost is tremendous, so we have to be careful in how we do things, how we move forward to make sure emergency communications stay intact.
Director Walburn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Your point is well taken, sir. The national deployment of the broadband network is not part of our division, and that is through a deed. And although we partner with them and we try to retain a strong relationship with them, that installation is outside of the immediate scope of our division.
Thank you, Director Walbrook. I was thinking the same thing, and I was trying to figure out where, so thank you for providing that information. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, our second emergency communication network is our land mobile radio system, often referred to as ARMOR, the acronym for Allied Radio Matrix for Emergency Responders. That is a successful program that we have achieved in collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. It is a state-of-the-art system. It's the envy of almost every one of the other 50 states, and it has proven itself over and over again to be both reliable and robust. By way of example, when the 35W bridge collapsed a number of years ago, that system performed seamlessly and flawlessly, and emergency responders that came in from all around the state were able to communicate with one another using that land mobile radio system. So we're very proud of that in the state of Minnesota. That is an 800 megahertz system, and nearly every public safety entity within the state of Minnesota is on that system with their radios. Our third emergency communication network program is our wireless broadband program. Now, this is a relatively new program, and our first initiative was as tasked by the federal government to work to advise the governor of the state of Minnesota on whether or not our state should opt in or not opt in to the FirstNet project. FirstNet is the National Public Safety Broadband Network, and the first task of our wireless broadband division was to perform research to identify where there are gaps in wireless coverage across the state of Minnesota and to make recommendations on where some of those changes need to be made to improve that. And back in December of 2017, Governor Dayton opted in to the National FirstNet program, and Minnesota was the 23rd state to do so. Today, all 50 states and 6 territories have opted in to the FirstNet program. What FirstNet will provide for public safety is a dedicated public safety network that's using a band of spectrum that is separate from what the commercial carriers are using today. AT&T was awarded the contract for that by the federal government, and today AT&T is, as part of that contract, they're increasing the infrastructure across the nation in order to better support the needs of public safety. If we look again at the bridge collapse incident, and those of you that may have even been trying to use your wireless phone to call a family member or to call your children or just to get information on the incident, you probably weren't able to get through. You probably dialed a number and you either got a fast, busy signal or you got a recorded message saying that all circuits were busy. This was happening to the responders who were on the scene as well, who were maybe trying to call one another or try to call in for additional resources. So what the National Public Safety Band Network is providing is a dedicated band class for emergency responders, and it will provide them with priority and preemption service on that band so that when something large happens and everybody goes to use their cell phones, it'll bump all of the emergency responders that have service through FirstNet to a dedicated network where they will be able to continue to communicate about the incident. So this is an important aspect. And this is the collaboration with our public safety partners across the state at looking at when is the correct time for them to move or consider moving over to FirstNet is the focus of this division now. In addition to that, they're examining collaboration tools that they can look at to further help, like an application would be an example that maybe every first responder would be able to have on their phone, a shared application that everybody could use to communicate with back and forth. So while this is a relatively new program, we are starting to look at different ways to continue to collaborate and work together with all of our public safety stakeholders across the state. And finally, our fourth program is the
Question. We have a question for Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. As I think about this in relation to the mobile landline, is this intended at some point to replace? Is it to enhance? Is this an add-on? Can you talk about the relationship of how emergency responders would use the two possible different systems differently?
I was thinking the same thing, Representative Dean, what the interconnects between this. And so, Director Walbert.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is not our intent to replace the current land mobile radio system, but rather to have two diverse and redundant means of communication so that in the event that something would fail with either one or the other, that there would still be an opportunity for responders to be able to communicate. Now, at some point in time, it may be that there would be one single device that they would be able to use to do that, rather than having two separate devices, but that is yet to be determined.
Thank you. Please proceed, Director.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our fourth emergency communication network program is the Integrated Public Alert and Warning System, known as IPAWS. And our primary focus in this area is on education and outreach. It's a combination of networking with our public safety partners to ensure that at least within every county there is at least one, if not more, devices that are capable of initiating an IPAWS alert and warning. And the second task is to ensure that we're working closely with the broadcasters, and that includes television, radio, telephone, and cable providers, to ensure that they are a solid public partner in this, because we will be relying on them to perform a function in, and you've probably seen or heard these on your TV when you see the crawler come across that is providing an alert. Typically it's weather related, and that is initiated through the National Weather Service. But in the event that there would be a need to evacuate an area due to a toxic fume or some type of a terrorist attack, these public safety communication centers would be able to perform that that task and identify a geofenced area that was at risk, put an imaginary fence around that, and then provide an alert to everybody that was within that area. And that could either be done using a partnership with the broadcast industry, or it could be done as a wireless alert that would hit every cell phone tower within that area and would alert everyone who had a cell phone within that area, whether or not they lived in that area or not. So it's a very comprehensive notification, and we will continue to work to enhance that and make it more robust and reliable across the state. Today we have 72 entities that are IPAWS enabled, and that has grown over the past year, and we expect it to continue to grow until we reach all 87 counties. finally, some of our other initiatives include, and these are all focusing kind of on the umbrella of interoperability. While each one of these programs has their own swim lane, if you will, it's very important that they work together, because we don't have interoperability if everybody is in their own track. So while it's important for our staff of 13 to continue to work strongly within their own track, they also must look at being able to provide interoperability between and amongst agencies, between and amongst programs, and between and across borders, other states, the Canadian border, which is our neighbors to the north. So that we're always looking to do enhance our overall interoperability. And in doing that, we develop standards and training to make sure that everybody's following the same protocols and everybody is trained equally across the state, and also that we have the opportunity to provide grant funding that will benefit all of our stakeholders, whether they have small budgets or large budgets. We don't want to leave anybody behind. So with that, I'll close in saying that our budget is a little over $77 million a year. None of that comes from the general fund of the state. We are completely self-funded, and our source of funding comes primarily from the 95 cents that is assessed on every Minnesotan's telephone bill, whether it's wireless, wireline, or voice over IP. And then we are also the recipient of some occasional grants. And with that, I will stand for any additional questions.
Very well. Thank you, Director Wahlberg. We do have a couple of questions. Representative Edelson.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Chair. So in terms of spreading out, you said you are not in all the counties yet. Do you have a plan for that? What does that look like?
We do. We have an, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we do have a plan. We have a dedicated IPAWS program manager who has been going out regularly to perform education and outreach within every region. We have the state divided into seven regions, and he's actively visiting all of those. We have provided some there is funding available through the 911 grant that PSAPs receive monthly. They're able to use that money specifically to purchase notification equipment. And what's very important is Mr. Dooley has been going out and assisting entities in performing live testing. Some of what has cautioned entities from becoming engaged or from purchasing this equipment is because they don't want to make a mistake. They don't want to put out a false alarm. That you may recall that something very significant happened in the state of Hawaii a few months ago where an inadvertent nuclear attack alarm went out. And so we've actually been going around call center to call center, sitting down with the staff, helping them feel comfortable and being able to successfully put out a live test. And now we're asking them to do that weekly. And that number is also increasing. So I think between the comfort and the support that we will see that come to fruition.
Representative Adelson.
And just for clarity, you do plan to see that, but do you have a timeline? Do you have an expectation over the next 3 years, over the next 4 years?
That is, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have a three-year strategic plan that we just started in January, and that project is scheduled to be completed no later than the end of that three-year plan. We fully anticipate that that will occur sooner.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director. It seems like you guys are on top of a lot of things, and it seems like Minnesota is leading the way in lots of areas, so thank you for that. And I just want to make a comment that I'm happy to contribute $11.40 every year to this fund.
Thank you, Representative Dean. We, the state of Minnesota and the people of Minnesota, thank you as well. Director Wahlberg, we had a good conversation yesterday, and I was just intrigued by the work that your division does. And I was immediately impressed with the ability of every corner of this state and its public safety community to be able to quickly and effectively communicate with one another. It's an impressive vision, I think, that we've had as Minnesotans to be able to create that. I'm real pleased that the state of Minnesota is doing all it can to make sure that your division is empowered to continue to push, particularly in an era where there's just rapid changes, particularly in technology and the desire and the wisdom of several jurisdictions being able to interact with one another, including with our federal jurisdictions as well. So I look forward to continuing this conversation with you, and we will, members, make sure we do a good dive, particularly for our newer members, about what our responsibilities are relative to the special revenue funds that provide support for this division and for others as well. So thank you for being with us here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's been a pleasure, and we look forward to continuing to work closely with you.
All right. Very well. Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'd like to introduce the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, which we affectionately call HSEM, Director Joe Kelly.
Wonderful. Welcome, Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to give you a little background information of what, as the commissioner said, HSEM, as we are known by initials, what we do to contribute to the department's operations to keep the people of Minnesota, keep the Minnesota safe. Our mission statement is pretty simple. It's to help Minnesota prepare for, respond to, and recover from emergencies and disasters. And I take that second word, help, very seriously when we look at how the focus of our work is on a daily basis. Our job is to help communities, so cities, townships, counties, and tribes know how they're going to respond when they have an incident, when they have an emergency on their hands, and then also to help them develop the resiliency to recover from the effects of a disaster, whether it's a tornado, a flood, a hazardous materials incident, or so forth. We have both Homeland Security and Emergency Management in our name. We do have a role in Homeland Security, but our primary stock and trade is in the emergency management business. If you want to think of a federal parallel to us, even though my staff shudders a little bit when I say this, we are a state emergency management agency. So our federal counterpart is FEMA, much more than it is to the overall Department of Homeland Security on the federal level, which includes the Coast Guard and Customs and Border Protection, et cetera. We do have some roles to play in the Homeland Security realm, though. This slide shows, Mr. Chair, members, shows our primary service lines. I'm not going to go over each one. We'll be happy to answer questions, but I want to highlight a couple. The first is under the preparedness service line, where we talk about helping communities be prepared for school safety incidents. We have a small team. It's three staff that go out and advise and assist school administrators and faculty and staff on the condition of their facilities, their readiness to handle an incident or emergency at their school, as well as to help them review their emergency operations plan. Do they know what they're going to do if they have, God forbid, a shooter come into their school? We also provide support for local school exercises to practice those plans, because as those like Representative Johnson, who have been in the emergency services world, you're going to play the way you practice, and practice makes perfect. And the same is true for our schools when it comes to being able to respond to an incident.
Director Kelly, I'm going to interrupt quickly. Representative Russell has a question.
Just quickly, you're talking about preparedness. Last session, myself and Representative Nash had some continuity of government bills to move forward. Can you tell us, is there anything that's ongoing to make sure that, you know, in such a case as a disaster of whatever type, that we can keep all the branches of government moving forward so that we can keep, keep it functioning?
Director,
Mr. Chair, Representative Grossel, yes, each of the executive branch agencies currently have responsibility under a governor's executive order to be prepared for what at the agency level we call continuity of operations, to be able to continue to provide the critical services that all the agencies provide to the citizens of Minnesota, even in the event of an emergency. The companion to that, and it was, I think, more specifically to what the bill last session addressed, is continuity of government. How do we continue to ensure that not only the executive branch agencies, but also the legislative branch and the judiciary, to ensure that they have adequate plans, procedures, facilities, and practice those procedures in the event of an interruption of normal operations. Representative, as you know, and Mr. Chair and other members, there's that bill, I think, was caught up at the end of the session, and there's still a lot of work to do there. And I look forward to working, Mr. Chair, with the committee on the issue of continuity of government.
Very well. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, we're currently, I don't know, it seems to go 33 days federal government shutdown. How has that impacted any of the work that you do in your office? And if it doesn't have an impact now, when do you think that that could have an impact?
And Director Keller, I suspect answer probably should be filtered through all four of these areas, right? Mitigation, prevention, recovery, response, as well as preparedness. But please.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Dean. Fortunately, so far we only are experiencing what I would call some acute pain in one area, and that is with a pending federal disaster declaration that the governor asked sent to FEMA for the president at the end of November. Those decisions, determinations, typically take between 30 and 45 days from the time they leave the state. Of course, right at the midpoint of that timeline or thereabouts is when the federal government shut down. So that determination about whether St. Louis County and the city of Duluth are going to be eligible for federal disaster assistance from their storm in October will not be made until after the furlough and the shutdown ends and the furlough that goes with it. For our other programs, whether they are emergency preparedness or disaster assistance or homeland security grants that we get from the federal government, because as you'll see on another slide, we only get about 23% of our funding from state general funds. We are very reliant on federal money that comes from the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA. The good news is for the money that we are currently spending, that money was previously appropriated by the Congress last year. So in effect, we have money, figuratively, we have money in our federal bank accounts from FEMA, and we are able to continue to draw those down for pretty much all of the things you see on the screen. Where the programs, where it will become challenging for us is if the federal government gets to the end of the current federal fiscal year and no money has been appropriated for fiscal year 19, and then all of the programs on the screen will probably be at a great deal of risk for continuation, maybe with the one exception of disaster relief. The federal disaster relief fund is appropriated separately, quite similarly to how the state handles our disaster contingency account in Minnesota. So to give a short answer at the end of the long one, currently the only impact is on our request for Duluth. We're okay for a couple of months. Mr. Chair, if I could, an item of interest and concern that has come up over the past couple of weeks, I have been contacted by two of our tribal nations who are facing a financial crisis, a disaster, an emergency, because they are very dependent on a continuous flow of federal funds for their operations, asking if a disaster declaration would be in order or would be appropriate to help them get through this time of the interruption of federal funding. Consulting with the FEMA regional administrator in Chicago and their attorneys, the answer, unfortunately, is no. An interruption of the federal government shutdown and an interruption of funding does not meet the standard of a precipitating event to trigger assistance under the Stafford Act. So that is an area of concern, I would imagine, across all of government. I'm going to have a conference call with the tribal emergency managers on Monday to get a sense of what's happening in those tribal nations and have them share information across their governments.
We're clearly in uncharted waters nowadays, and the stresses, I think, are starting to present themselves and challenge us. But Representative Dee?
Thank you.
Director Kelly.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other program I will highlight under the preparedness mission area is radiological emergencies. That primarily deals with the preparedness of government at all levels to deal with an accident or incident in one of our two nuclear generating plants. That program, my staff and its operations are funded by a special revenue account through an assessment from Xcel Energy. Under response, I would like to highlight the coordination of the state response teams. And we just talked specifically about bomb squads, hazardous materials response teams, and a technical rescue task force. We have four bomb squads. They are hosted by Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Bloomington, as well as Crow Wing County. The arrangement we have, the contractual arrangement we have with them, is that when a jurisdiction other than the home jurisdiction needs help with dealing, rendering safe an explosive device, they call us and we dispatch one of those bomb squads and they become agents of the state. And we pay for that response outside of their jurisdiction. So St. Paul, for example, does not have to pay for the cost of dealing with an explosive device in North Branch. For example, we have the same arrangement with 11 fire departments for hazardous materials response teams, and five fire departments make up the technical rescue task force, which essentially is collapsed building, collapsed structural rescue capabilities.
And Director Kelly, what are those five fire department jurisdictions?
For the task force?
Yes.
It is Minneapolis, St. Paul, Edina, Rochester, and then Dakota County Special Operations Team. And there are some other departments that contribute individuals to those teams, but those are the five that contribute to the Technical Rescue Task Force.
And Director Kelly, how is that deployed? Is that just incredibly flexible and adaptive, or is it matching up particular challenges of an incident, or is it geographic deployment?
Mr. Chair and members, when the local incident commander, whether he's a fire chief or a sheriff or a police chief, sees the need for one of those capabilities, they will call the Minnesota Duty Officer, which, as members may know, is a 24/7 answering point over at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And if they ask for one of those teams, their call will be referred to one of my on-call staff. We have staff that are also on call. And depending on the incident, they will ask questions, help that incident commander assess it, make sure that it meets the standards. The teams for deployment, and then my guys will tell them to deploy and support those hazardous materials teams and the bomb squads. They've divided the state up into service areas so that they have geographic alignment and responsibilities, but they can deploy anywhere in the state. And oftentimes, for large events, we anticipate it might take more than one team. So that's kind of the procedure, and there is some geographic orientation, Mr. Chair.
Very well. It seems like I can only imagine your efforts and the efforts of all the partners to constantly work on efficiency of operations and communications, because you know you've got to be able to filter through to make the right decision. Then you actually have to get bodies out there as quickly as possible, and we're a pretty big state.
Mr. Chair, you are correct. We are a big state. We are grateful to those communities that host these teams organically and enter into contracts with us. You know, in exchange for being able to use them out of jurisdiction, we provide them with equipment and training and other opportunities to make their teams more capable. It's kind of, not to be trite, it's kind of one of those Minnesota miracles, mm-hmm. in that it's a really good model. There are some states that have state employees and state vehicles and state facilities, and that's all they do. This is a dual-use capability that gets to the heart of neighbors helping neighbors and mutual aid and being cost-effective.
Director Kelly, Minnesotans are above average. Representative Lush has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Kelly, help me understand. If we got a Chernobyl in Monticello, in what agency do we house those specialized teams who are going to respond to that? Where are they located and how are they trained?
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, the responsibilities that the state has in the arrangement we have with the federal government to deal with accidents or incidents on those at those two plants deal with what we call offsite. So our responsibilities are to make protective action decisions to alert and warn the public and tell them what to do if that means evacuating or staying in place and other things. On site, that is the responsibility of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the operator. They have the trained technical experts that deal with the plant and all of its systems, to include inspectors and evaluators from the NRC that are there on a daily basis. So the state does not have responsibility for dealing with the reactor and the challenges therein. That is a capability that the generator, the power company, has to demonstrate to the NRC in order to maintain their operating license. Mm-hmm. We have to maintain readiness to keep the public safe.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lush.
And Director Kelly, so those would all be Federal Department of Energy employees then who would respond directly to that, and no one under your aegis or state government employee or local government employee in here would be responsible for that. Am I understanding you correctly? I mean, as far as going in and finding out of what's really wrong in the reactor.
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, that is correct. Okay. Our responsibilities, state, local, county level, are off-site protecting the public.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Lesh. Representative Lucetto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Kelly. So the last couple of years I've been to presentations on the growing threat of EMP, electromagnetic pulse, and to the electronics that our society continuously becomes more dependent on. Would a response of an incident of that nature fall under your purview? And if it does, has that an incident of that nature been on your radar and part of maybe some conversations that have taken place within your department? And that sparked when you have the radio or the bullet point up there, the radiological emergency. Traditionally, an EMP is a byproduct of an incident of that nature, but in these presentations I've attended, that there is equipment available now that threat actors can put together to develop something of that nature for a localized incident, which would be devastating. So just want to hear your thoughts on that. Thank you.
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it's certainly on our radar screen, if you will. It is one of the scenarios that we work with local emergency managers and incident commanders, as well as the providers of the systems that would be most impacted by electromagnetic pulse, the power companies, the telecommunications industry, and so forth. Our focus as an emergency management agency is to think about what the impacts of that would be. a loss of electric power, loss of communications, and so forth, and then work with local officials to deal with the impacts. At the end of the day, for a citizen that we serve, the impact of a loss of electricity is the same whether it's from an ice storm, a tornado, or electromagnetic pulse. Obviously, it's a different scenario if it's a terrorist act. But we focus on the impacts on particularly the what we call the lifeline sectors of critical infrastructure, and how would we help people when those things take place regardless of cause. But the cause and the threat is one that we do pay attention to, so does the federal government, and so do the providers of those systems. And it's daunting, quite honest. When you look at how much of us are, how dependent we are on digital communications, telecommunications, electricity for everything, and data exchange, to lose that to anything is significant.
Representative Lucet.
Thank you, and I just a quick follow-up. You're right, and even so the infrastructure electrical grid would be impacted. Even once power is restored, if all of the endpoints themselves were also impacted, even with electricity restored, these wouldn't be operational. And I could imagine all the chips and everything embedded within gas stations, fuel pump, I mean, everything wouldn't work even with power restored. So it is daunting, and it's one that is a great concern.
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. And it is something I think that those of us that serve in government need to think about, our ability to help the people we serve after an event like that. Do we have the capability as state agencies, as branches of government, to come back quickly back up and be there for the people that we serve, because we will be just as impacted as they are. So when we look at for example, our State Emergency Operations Center, we see a lot of vulnerabilities to interruptions of power and communications and just physical security, and we'll be interested in discussing those in the future so that we can be sure that we'll be there when people need us the most. Mr. Chair, I often say that in the times that we live, people accept. This is a tongue twister, so I have to say it carefully. They accept with an AC that things are going to happen. There's going to be a tornado. There's going to be a flood or a fire. God forbid there could be a terrorist attack. They expect with an EX that somebody's going to be there to help them. Somebody's going to know what to do. Somebody's going to have a plan. And that's, again, a daunting responsibility that the people that I work with take very seriously and try to live up to every day.
Thank you, Representative Lucetto, for your question, and Chairman Lesh for his, because I think this is an important point, and you've made it several times, that helps us to understand what HSEM, their focal point and mission is in our state. And you said earlier the focus on impact of people and infrastructure, regardless of what the source is, although certainly not oblivious to what the source is. And so that no doubt gets us into communications with other parts of both our state and federal government. But this, I think, really lifts up the value that we place as Minnesotans in terms of using our state government to be there with our citizenry in order to recover as quickly as possible and get back to healthy and normal, living conditions. So thank you for making that point. Thanks for your question, Representative Lucero. Director Kelly, please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To just highlight a couple details of the programs, talk a little bit about some of the financials that you asked about earlier. We do get $2.6 million in our base state funding, as I said earlier. That represents about 23% of our operating budget. The rest comes from special revenue, like the Excel energy assessment for power plant preparedness, and then a large amount from federal grants for everything from disaster preparedness to disaster recovery and homeland security. As you can see in the second bullet, We act as a fiscal agent, if you will, a state administrative agency that passes those grant funds down to the local level, estimated in fiscal year 19 to be $44 million. So again, those local units of government are depending on and counting on those federal grant dollars coming down and helping with their operations. I already mentioned the 11 hazardous materials response team. We do get money from the fire safety account that Marshall West discussed, base funding of $850,000 a year. And again, that's to help them provide that capability not only for their community, but more importantly for those outside of it. The bomb squads get a reasonably modest amount. Again, there's just four bomb squads. We get $160,000 from state general funds. I thank the legislature. We went from $110,000 a year to $160,000 a year. That goes toward funding those calls that they make outside of their jurisdiction. We had found over time that the communities that host that were actually subsidizing that program because our budget did not allow them to reimburse them for their actual costs, as well as some financial protections and workers' compensation, so tort protections and workers' compensation, so that when they go out representing the state, if something happens, they're protected, their communities are protected from the liability, and so is the state. So thank you for that raise for them last year. The school safety center is another one I would highlight. It's a pretty modest team. There's three people. They have a base budget of $400,000 a year, and again, it's to go out and advise and assist those local school administrators about how to provide a safe environment for their students and staff. Finally, in our role as the State Emergency Management Agency, we do administer state and federal disaster assistance, and that's done through the disaster assistance contingency account that the legislature created back in 2014. Since that time, more than $50 million has gone from that account to local government to help them recover from natural disasters primarily. It was a busy year for disasters in Minnesota in 2018. We had 10 qualifying events that met the thresholds and the standards for either state or federal disasters that did $40 million worth of damage to Minnesota's communities. That's $40 million that is outside of a local, outside their local budgets. It impacted 49 counties and four tribal nations. And when you get down to who's actually applying and getting checks to reimburse them for their eligible costs, there are more than 450 local applicants when we're talking again about cities and townships and schools and police departments and so forth. Dana mentioned that the 800 megahertz radio network is the envy of most of our friends and neighbors across the country. So is this program, the program that has two important things. One is dedicated funding so that money is available immediately after a disaster. And the other is that the state of Minnesota has a program when FEMA is not going to help. Remember I said there were 10 incidents. Eight of those didn't rise to the threshold of qualifying for federal assistance. But because Minnesota has a disaster assistance program absent federal aid, your communities were able to get help recovering. Mr. Chair and members, that concludes my remarks.
Thank you, Director Kelly. I do want to just share with members as we've talked through with leadership about where some of these accounts or where all these accounts are going to lie, that the expectation, it's my understanding, the expectation of the Disaster Relief Fund, I think that's the official name, it will not be in this division, but rather I believe will be in the committee that Chairman Pawlowski, Greater Minnesota Economic Development Committee. There has been some talk, you don't need to reflect on or comment on this unless you choose to, Director Kelly. There has been some talk that and you talked about how 2018 was a big year. And so we got to be careful, you know, because, you know, I think this fund has been around since 2014.
Correct.
So we're only working off of essentially 4 years of data. But there is some talk and concern that there may be a trend in terms of of natural incidences that would trigger the need for this kind of state intervention. It doesn't take a rocket scientist, frankly, to walk that over to changes that are happening with our global climate. And anyone knows anything a little bit about global climate issues, the issue really has to do with really extreme concentrated incidences. So, floods, severe rainfall, severe drought, whatever it is. I mention it because I think it poses for us as a legislature a question about how do we plan going forward. Have we planned for this fund relative to trends and behaviors from prior decades and prior experiences? Should we now be looking at data much more closely to see whether or not we need to adjust what our assumptions are, and therefore perhaps what our use of state resources are in order to help our communities. I was really struck, Director Kelly, 49 counties and 4 tribal nations. So this is a big deal. At one time, I've been here long enough to know that and to have experience coming into special sessions on a regular basis to deal with these issues. And I think we came up with a wiser way so that we have a set amount of resources that are immediately helpful so that folks aren't waiting for us to get our work done at the legislature, but they know that those local community safety folks can move as quickly as possible to help their residents. We do have a question from Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You and I have talked previously, and I think Chair Mariani just mentioned some issues that I think about. And my question is, how broad is the provision for prevention? And when we think of critical infrastructure, I mean, what is sort of your ability to address some of these issues that could come up next year, could come up the year after that? My hope is that these incidences of more natural disasters, and I use the word natural carefully, is that we can do something, and it's not just one group trying to address this within government or within the administration. It's a broad spectrum. And before you answer that, I just want to say I'm a little concerned that all disaster money would sit in a committee that's primarily looking at Greater Minnesota.
We, Representative Dean, we do have disaster incidences in the Twin Cities urban areas. Well, I could tell you with the Mississippi River running through my district, we've had many years where we've had very serious infrastructure damage as well as vast disruption to the flow of traffic and way of life. But Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, mitigation and prevention of damage to not only critical infrastructure but property, both public and private properties, is of great concern. You look at it at the federal level and the amount of money that is being spent on these tremendous hurricanes, wildfires in California, and so forth. The FEMA administrator is telling me and my peers across the country, we have got to do more to get ahead of this with mitigation and prevention. Research shows that for every dollar that we collectively across the country invest in mitigation, prevents $6 of future damages. And that's without evaluating the interruption of people's lives. And the thing you mentioned, Mr. Chair, about people just want things to get back to normal after we have a significant event. In that regard, you will see from the federal government going forward more opportunities, more federal funding opportunities for mitigation projects, if you will. And we talk about critical infrastructure, the fortifying of storm sewer systems, the burying of power lines around, particularly around critical structures, the raising of roads and bridges so they don't get washed away or closed, in floods. So you will see more opportunities from the federal government in what they call pre-disaster mitigation, but that will require the commitment of resources at the state or local level to take advantage of that. It is an area that I think everybody in my profession, we would much rather be doing mitigation than disaster recovery. As a nation, we are underspending on this relative to our experience.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have one last question, Representative Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really quick. So you said that we had 10 emergency events, large emergency events, $40 million. What percentage of those were weather-related?
Director Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Christensen, I'm happy to tell you 100% of those are related to weather. The number one natural hazard threat in Minnesota is flooding. What's interesting, and it goes back to your comments, Mr. Chair, about kind of changes in weather patterns, to keep it simple. The last time Minnesota experienced a major spring flood from snowmelt was 2011, and St. Paul was right in the middle of that. If you will recall, Mr. Chair, we got lucky because we had a perfect melt when it was teed up to be the flood of record here. But we have had federal disaster declarations for flooding in 12, 13, 14, 16, and now in 18 from high-volume rain events, primarily in the June and July timeframes. And what happens is a community will get 6, 8, 10, 12 inches of rain in one episode. And the stormwater systems, the wastewater systems, the water treatment plants simply weren't designed to absorb that capacity. So natural disasters are our number one cause. We do, of course, have tornadoes and ice storms once in a while, but it's water. It's flooding. To a question it might have been, Mr. Chair, that either you or Representative Dean asked, we in state government and the federal government are trying to take a interagency look at that problem. So there's a climate adaptation team here in Minnesota that is led by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Natural Resources. The DOT participates on it, as do we, trying to take a look at what's changing in the world that we live in and what do we have to do to adapt primarily our infrastructure so that it is more resilient from the impacts of severe weather and storms in the future.
Thank you very much. Thanks to everyone, the whole panel. Thank you.
Director Kelly, I can't remember the year, but I remember several years ago driving, and Representative Constantine is here, driving through the Minnesota Valley region, probably on my way to Mankato, perhaps a little bit further, and just astounded by the amount of water that had followed a major torrential rainfall incident in that region. I can't remember, so many years ago, but it does paint for me a very visual picture of both the beauty of Minnesota, but also the vulnerability of our state relative particularly to water, high-value water rate events. Members, we're going to have to adjourn. Director Kelly, thank you for your testimony today. We look forward to our continued work with you this year. Deputy Director O'Hearn, thank you. Did I say that correctly, your last name?
O'Hearn, yes.
O'Hearn, very good. Thank you for being here with your incredibly talented and committed staff to share vital information with us. So with that, members, we'll stand adjourned until next week. All right, thank you.
Thank you.